double trouble. If it's not enough that Nehemiah has to deal with the opposition in earnest that we saw last week in chapter number 4, now he has problems within. Think of that for a moment. It's sort of like you get a double portion. Only in this case, it's not a blessing so much, at least outwardly looking at it. Double trouble. Persecution from without. Now he faces problems from within. I have to tell you, though, there's a lesson already in this when you think about this chapter, because it's what you should expect. It's what I should expect. We shouldn't be surprised by it. Just as I said last time, when you look at the opposition that was created and the blowback that occurred in chapter number 4, as Nehemiah is seeking to move God's people forward, we shouldn't be surprised by that, nor should we really be surprised by the other that I'm going to talk about this morning, and that is the problems that sometimes arise from within. I just want to tell you that this is true, whether you're thinking of your personal spiritual life, whether you're trying to engage spiritually, whether you're trying to accept a challenge from God. God is speaking to your heart, and you're trying to move your life forward out of a comfort zone. You're trying to move your life forward spiritually. Expect it. Expect blowback. If you're in leadership, you may be the pastor of a church. You might be deacons in the church. You might be trustees in the church. And you have the responsibility of trying to seek God's face and determine what it is that God has to move the work of the ministry that resides in this particular local church forward. How do you do that? What does God want you to do? Well, we're trying to do that, but you can expect this. And I just think it's important for us to realize that so that when it happens, we don't think, well, something's really wrong here, something's unusual. No, this is par for the course. Here it is, in an agricultural metaphor. If you put your hand to the plow, which is also a biblical metaphor, expect to hit both rocks. It's going to happen. If you put your hand to the plow, expect to hit both rocks. Persecution or some type of opposition from without and problems from within. It just seems to happen. Now, here's something really interesting to point out. Having said that, I want us to really examine, this is kind of going to be the heart of the message this morning. I want us to look at how it is that Nehemiah responds, because we've pointed out in the opening message to this series that, and called Nehemiah the quintessential leader. What's he going to do to respond to this new problem that he faces? And the reason that I'm so interested in looking to see what he's going to do to face this problem is because I want to take you down to verse number 16 and show you something. When all is over and said and done, look at verse 16, the first part. He says this, "Yea, also I continued or persevered in the work of this wall." In other words, whatever it is that Nehemiah does, God uses the leadership steps that he takes in response to this new problem, and at the end of the day, the mission was intact. The work on the wall continued. What do we want to take away from this? What do we want to, if we can't get anything else, what's an overarching principle? What's an overarching lesson that we can take away from this? And here it is. Basically, it's this, that we have to face our problems, regardless of what those problems are, whether we're a church or whether we're individuals and thinking about our private life, we have to face our problems in two ways. We have to face them prayerfully or from a platform of piety, which I used that word in my opening message on chapter number 1, where I talked about his qualities and mentioned as a leader that mentioned the very first one of piety or prayer. It was the foundation of everything, and that has to be there. Absolutely has to be there. When you face your problems, because if you're going to face your problems, you need to know what it is God wants you to do in response. But the next part of that is we have to face our problems, not just prayerfully, but we have to face them decisively if we would see them resolved. See, here's the problem. We're all made up of human flesh, and in the weakness of that flesh, no one really wants confrontation. Unless you're a nut. No one really wants to pick a fight. No one really wants a sticky wicket. No one really wants to have to go to someone and talk about a problem. Or no one really wants to face a problem in his own life. It's a whole lot easier for us to kind of sweep it under the carpet, ignore it, hope it will go away, or perhaps we could just call a truce. Perhaps we could just sort of have like the North and South Korea deal where there really was never any official peace, just an armistice. Here's the question I have for you about that. With the North and South Korea deal, do we really have a resolution? Hello? Do we really have a resolution? No, we don't have a resolution. And why don't we have a resolution? We don't have a resolution because what was declared was a truce or an armistice, and we never really finished the job. We never really dealt with the situation to the fullest extent that it needed to be dealt with. The reason that I'm using a military metaphor at this point is because I want to introduce a quotation to you from General Douglas MacArthur that I think really is apropos at this point. Peace isn't a truce. What we seek is peace. You have to be a nut if you're looking for anything else. And I really like that, by the way, this past week about Benjamin Netanyahu's speech. What we really want is peace. But there's a divergence of ideas on how you get there. The current philosophy, and I'm not trying to politicize, this is just the honest truth. The current philosophy is that you kind of sweep these problems under the carpet and you don't really deal with them. You know what that's going to end up to, don't you? You're not really solving the problem. You're basically copping out because you're a weakling. You won't really confront the real problem at hand. And it's not the way to have a lasting peace. So listen as MacArthur continues. A truce just says you don't shoot for a while. Peace comes when the truth is known, the issue is settled, and the parties embrace each other. Isn't that what we want? Don't we want that in the world today? Don't we want that in North and South Korea and for their contribution to the world? Don't we want that in the Middle East? But folks, we never seem to learn the lessons of history, right? Even in the run-up to World War II, think about this for a moment. They didn't want war. Well, who would want war? But in Britain, Neville Chamberlain couldn't stand up to Hitler. I mean, it was as plain as the nose on your face what Hitler was doing. So Hitler would annex something, Hitler would annex something else, and Neville Chamberlain's policy was known as one of, do you know the word? Starts with an A, appeasement. Didn't work, did it? It didn't work because you can't appease evil. You can't oppose, let's bring it over into the church, let's bring it over into the spiritual realm. You can't appease sin. You can try. You can do that because it's the easier thing to do, but it never really brings a resolution. You have to face your problems prayerfully, first of all. Then you have to face them decisively if we would see them resolved. All right, let's talk about what was the problem. We didn't have a good handle on what this problem was, and I'll try to move as quickly as I can through this. But here you have a people. I want you to identify. That's why I reread verse number 1. There was a great cry of the people. Let's try for a moment to identify with the people, all right? Since Nehemiah chapter 1, we've kind of seen some of the conditions that were current there in Jerusalem. We saw the actual and spiritual decline. We see that they have enemies from without and all of these kinds of things. So here you have a people who are already discouraged by reproach. Remember that back in chapter 4, verse 1? Sanballat and his group, it says at the end of the verse, mocked the Jews. Not really easy. So here you have a people that are already discouraged by the humiliation and reproach that Sanballat tried to use as a weapon against them. They're discouraged by physical exertion. That discourages me this morning. Does it discourage you sometimes? When I don't feel my best, when I don't feel like I can really do the job as I want to do the job, that discourages me. I'm not going to complain. I like the philosophy of the black man that told me one time, I thanks the Lord I live long enough to get old. So I'm not going to complain, but it has its challenges, doesn't it? Physical exertion, do we see that? We sure did. Look at chapter 4, verse 10. And Judah said, the strength of the bearers of the burdens is decayed. You don't think all that work that they finished that wall in 52 days was easy, do you? All that rubbish they had to clear, the building they had to do. So we have two things going on if we want to try to identify with the people. Here they are, discouraged by the tactics of Sanballat. They're discouraged by exertion. And another tactic of Sanballat was the threats. We saw that in chapter 4, verse 12. It came to pass when the Jews were dealt, which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, from all places whence ye shall return unto us, they will be upon you. So if you try to put yourself into the mindset of these people, at the point at which we join the story this morning when they cry out against their fellow Jews, you have a people already discouraged by reproach, exertion, threats, and now they're faced by something new. What are they faced by? They're faced by a lack of food. So in verse number 3, some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses that we might buy corn because of, and the King James says, dearth. You could use the word famine, but anyway you look at it, this is a new problem. This is a serious problem. This is a problem that really threatens the mission. Because you do have to eat. Your family has to eat. Here, think about it this way. Let's say you're a laborer. You're a man. I'm not saying there weren't some women that may have joined in, but probably the role of most of the women was supportive, as it often is, to be sure that the men were taken care of and the men were at top form, that they could do the work. But any man that's got any kind of a sense of what his role as a father is concerned about his wife and he's concerned about his family. Now his family's hungry. You're hungry. How are you supposed to do the work if you don't have strength to do the work? And your family. So they're distracted by this. This is a real problem. Not just to them personally, but it's a problem to the ongoing work of the Lord and the ongoing success. How do they respond to this? Well, first of all, you have the distraction, verse number 2, for there were that said, we, our sons, and our daughters are many. Got big family. Got a lot of mouths to feed. Therefore, it says, we take up corn for them. Or to make that just a little smoother and clearer for us, it might be that we would say, therefore, let us take up or get grain. So what are they saying? They're saying, could you give us some time off? We've been working these shifts, constantly working these shifts to get this wall built, but we've run out of food. Could you give us some time so that we can get out here and get some food for our families? So it becomes a true need, but it also becomes a distraction. How did some of the others respond? Well, some of the others responded in verse number 3, and it says, some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses that we might buy corn. You don't like to have to do that. Maybe you already have a mortgage. You know, take a second mortgage, man, that's a real hit. They didn't have any money. They were desperate. You sometimes do things like this when your family, you believe the welfare of your family is threatened, will drive a man to do a lot of things. Verse number 4, there were also, so here's another group of people that said, we have borrowed money. You don't like to do that either, do you? Do you? You realize that's illusory, don't you? You have to pay it back. So it's not necessarily wrong to borrow money, but we need to be careful about that, and we need to be careful about the kind of debt that we get into. So some people didn't see any other resort but to borrow money. And what were they borrowing money for? In this case, not even to buy the food. They were borrowing money to pay their taxes. That'll soon be true here. It'll soon be that you don't make enough to pay them, it seems. So this great cry goes up. Yet now our flesh, verse number 5, is as the flesh of our brethren. Here's the next thing that's happening. Our children are as their children. Lo, we bring bondage. So some responded to it by indenturing their children. Boy, that is nasty. Can you imagine having to resort to that? Selling your children into servitude. So conditions were not good, and these were the types of things that were happening, and this is the context. A people already wearied by threats, humiliation, physical exhaustion, now have to deal with a shortage of food. And right in the middle of all of this, what do we have? We have the nobles and the rulers continuing to charge interest on the rest of the people. Where do we get that? Verse 7, look at it. It says, "Then consulted I with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers," so here they are, "and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother." Usury in the King James Version is interest. All right, so I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but also look down at verse 10. We'll see this again, see the term come up again. "I likewise and my brethren and my servants," he says, "might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury." Wow. Well, folks, think about this for a moment. I have three things I want to say to you about this, but unfortunately, so many of these areas we could explore independently, and so many of them I think lots of people are interested in, and I don't have time. I'm sorry. It bothers me because I have the stuff here to tell you, but I just don't have time to do it. I'm just going to have to spit this out. This practice that these nobles and rulers were engaged in was, number one, I'm going to give you three thoughts about this. Number one, it was unbiblical. It was absolutely wrong. In fact, when you get down to verse number 9, Nehemiah says, "And I said, it is not good." Not good. But we could actually go a step further and say that it was unbiblical. And why is that? Well, I'm going to read you a verse from Leviticus chapter 25. And I think it's important for us to hear a biblical flavor of this so you don't think this is just my coloration or my thought. See, charging interest in and of itself is not necessarily wrong, but it was most definitely wrong in these circumstances. And so verse number 35 of Leviticus chapter 25, just listen to three verses here. It says, "And if thy brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him, yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury of him or increase, but fear thy God that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase." Well, I don't know. I wasn't there. It could be that they had these arrangements before these extremities came. In other words, some of these arrangements they may have entered into with their brothers when the conditions were different. I can't tell you all of that. I can only tell you what they're doing now is wrong. It's unbiblical. Because what God is saying is, it's one thing to have a reasonable practice and have reasonable expectations with what you do with your money and how you handle your money, and it's another thing to take advantage of someone else's hardships with your money. That's the big difference that's here. So what they were doing was unbiblical. Number two, what they were doing was unbecoming. That's why Nehemiah says to them, "And I said," verse number 9, "it is not good that ye do." Why wasn't it good? Well, the reason it wasn't good is because here they were, the Jews, and that's exactly what the hue and cry is. It's between the people. You have a segment of people who are complaining against their brothers for taking advantage of them, and all the while they're surrounded by the heathen, they're surrounded by unbelievers. So put it this way, think about it this way in your own heart and mind. Here we are in a church, right? And people say, well, in a church, they're supposed to love one another, and people say in a church, they're supposed to care for one another as brothers and sisters. Didn't they do that in the early church when they faced extreme circumstances? Remember in Acts chapter 2, they were facing extreme circumstances, and the Bible says in Acts 2, 44 and 45, they had all things, do you know the next word? Common. And it even says in the next verse that they went on to sell. Those who had possessions of lands went on to sell them to provide for people who had special needs. Well, see, that's what people expect of a church because that's what we claim of ourselves. So let's say that that's what they see of us, but or expect of us because we say we're a church, but instead they look in here and they see the opposite. They see some circumstances like this going on where there's conditions of hardship and difficulty, and maybe here somebody's gone down to the bank, got to take that second mortgage out to do this, and somehow a conversation comes up and the bank wants to know why you need this money. And it turns out that, well, you know, you owe this guy in the church this money, and he's got this thing and interest. And, whoa, man, what kind of testimony does that leave with him? What's he think about Calvary Independent Baptist Church then? What's he think about Christianity then? That's why I say it's unbecoming, and I don't have time to say more about it. I'd like to. But the last thought I'll give you is I'll call it unthinking. On the part of these nobles and rulers, this is totally thoughtless. This is totally unthinking. And why do I say that? Well, because they're not thinking of the bigger picture. They're only thinking of themselves. They're thinking about the gain. They're thinking about money that's owed them. I'm not saying that in the right context those things are not important, but that's all they're thinking about is themselves. They don't see the risk of what's going to happen here, that we've got a situation now of dissension. The church was faced with this too, don't you remember? You get a little bit further along in Acts, and there arose this cry of the Grecians, that is the Hellenistic Jews, against the other Jews because their widows were what? Neglected in the daily ministration. So now you've got the potential for a rift in the church. Now you've got a potential for a group over here upset with a group over here. How on earth do you follow the mission? How on earth do you accomplish the mission? See, this is something that's very important. This threatens what Nehemiah and what God want to accomplish in this place. I'll just say this, folks. You can slice it and dice it however you want to, but it boils down to selfishness. It just does. And unfortunately, all churches seem to have, they don't mean it to be that way perhaps, but all churches have some people in them that just, their world is their world. They don't have much thought for the bigger picture. Don't really think about what their actions, the implication of their actions for the church, their implications of their actions for the broader picture, the bigger ministry, or the mission. No, they're worried about themselves all the time. That's all they ever see is themselves. And that's really sad. But before I leave this, what I really want to say to you is I think we need to probe more deeply because there's something here you can get out of this that takes it deeper. Because here's my question to you. We'll all agree that what I presented to you this morning is a problem of selfishness, right? Pretty easy to see that. My question to you is, how does selfishness get the open door to creep into the heart? That's what I really want you to think about with me, because I think we can take this a little deeper. I think there's a clue, and out of that clue and probing a little bit more deeply comes a crucial point that I want to make in my message this morning. Well, it's a heart matter, to be sure. Selfishness is a heart matter. And even selfishness in the context that we're talking here this morning, God already tells it us in His Word that it's a heart matter. I would like now to read another verse to you that comes out of the Pentateuch that deals with this same problem. Listen in and see if you don't hear the word heart. If there be, this is Deuteronomy 15 and 7, if there be among you a poor man of any of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother. So it's a heart problem, we know that. But comes the question, all right, how did selfishness gain an open door into the heart? Because doesn't the Bible say, keep your heart, right? Guard your heart with all diligence, for out of the issues of life. What allowed their hearts to be fertile ground? What opened their hearts to this problem of selfishness, and it crept in and found lodging there? And I will tell you that it was a lack of commitment. I will tell you that there are a lot of people who fear commitment. I talk a lot about it, commitment, because I want to be committed. I did a series, I don't recall the exact time frame on it, but 2-3 years ago, and I had 7, 8, 9 messages on commitment, and since then I've had others that could easily have been put in that, put double entered with that commitment series. And it interests me that when I get the monthly report from Sermon Audio, it really interests me that those messages on commitment are some of the ones that keep coming up that people find. And I have no clue where they are. I mean, I see the breakdown in some of the states. I see them broken down by every state in the union. I see them broken down by foreign countries. I have no clue who these people are. But it interests me that commitment is a burden and a subject that a lot of people are interested in. I'm really burdened about commitment. And I find that by and large amongst God's people and in my own heart sometimes, we fear commitment. Why do we fear commitment? Afraid it's going to move us out of our comfort zone. Afraid God's going to ask of us something that we're not currently doing, that we really aren't sure if we're ready to do. Or in the worst case scenario, someone starts talking about service for God, and you think, well, I'm not going to give my, I wouldn't make myself a volunteer for full-time Christian service. My lands, I know what will happen. I'll end up being over there in the Sahara Desert passing out gospel tracts to camel caravans. That's what God will have for me. Well, I can't tell you what God has for you. He might have something for you, and I look at that and go, whoa, man, I don't know if I could do that. I'll tell you, I've seen people in this church be called upon to go through different circumstances in life, and I've done my best to be their pastor as they've gone through those difficult and challenging circumstances in their life, but there's been a many a time I've backed off and looked at that and gone, whoa. Man, God's grace really is sufficient. I wouldn't want to be where that person is right now. I don't know if I could do what that person is doing with the aplomb and the grace that they're doing it. But they are. And it magnifies the grace of God in them. But see, folks, there's something very practical about commitment that you have to take away from this message this morning. And I need to be reminded of. You shouldn't fear commitment because commitment is actually something God uses to protect our hearts so that the door is not open. See, if your heart is committed, if you're focused on the mission, if your heart's committed to those things that God is asking of you and you're sold out to those things, well, it's a little harder for the door of your heart to open and for the seeds of selfishness to get in there because you've already determined that's not the way you're going. And I want to tell you a story I've told you before, and I keep some of these around because they're some of my favorites, but I want to add a little something to the story this time that I don't think I've told you before. I've said before that I don't enjoy all operatic music, but I do enjoy some. And I don't know, I think it's probably safest to say that my favorite of tenors, he's now passed away, is Luciano Pavarotti. I love to, there's two people that I like to hear sing Oh Holy Night. One's David Donnelly and the other's Luciano Pavarotti. But there are other songs I like to hear him sing too. And if the truth be known, sometimes I put his recordings on and I'll go around the house with that. And it's a sight to behold. I'll tell you that. Early in life, Pavarotti's father, who was a baker, believe it or not, a baker, introduced the young boy to the wonders of music. He even made arrangements for him to study with a professional tenor who was in his hometown of Modena, Italy. So he took the lessons and studied voice and studied how to sing and all of those types of things. But concurrently, he had also enrolled in a teacher's college. And I can really identify with this because I remember when I was faced with the same decision and I was interested in engineering and physics. And then all of a sudden I got saved and I was really interested in the Bible. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know which way to go. And it was difficult. And I remember trying to do the very same thing I'm going to tell you about here. Dad, he graduated from the school and he asked his father, what shall I do? Shall I be a teacher or shall I be a singer? And his dad gave him some tremendously sage advice. To his son, he replied, Luciano, if you try to sit on two chairs, you will fall between them. for life, you must choose one chair. Choose one chair. Well, he chose one chair. He chose to sing. Do you know that it took 7 additional years of study and frustration before he had his first professional appearance? Do you know that it took an additional 7 years before he reached the Metropolitan Opera? And looking back, he leaves this testimony. He says, "And now I think whether it's laying bricks, writing a book, whatever we choose, we should give ourselves to it. Here's the thing you need to catch. Commitment. That's the key. Choose one chair." Jesus said it differently, but made the same point. No man can serve 2 masters. Doesn't work, does it? He said so. James said it differently. Same concept. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. And the problem, folks, is we shy away from commitment. We're afraid of commitment. And we're trying to sit on 2 chairs and it doesn't work. Somehow we're trying to pay lip service to Christianity. We're trying to do a little something for the Lord, but we really don't want to commit because we're afraid of commitment, all the while not realizing that what we have done when we pursue that course of action is to leave our hearts open. The doors are open for the subtle seeds of division to creep into our heart. Why? Because we're not committed to one person. We're trying to be committed to 2. Self and Jesus, and it doesn't work. There isn't enough room on the throne of your heart for 2 people. Choose one chair. E. Stanley Jones, the Methodist theologian and missionary of last century, put it this way: if you don't make up your mind, then your unmade mind will unmake you. Here is the place where there must be no dallying, for any dallying with the will be the Trojan horse that will get inside and open the gates to the enemy. There it is, the Trojan horse. Someone else said, God can do anything for the man who has made up his mind. He can do little or nothing for the double-minded. We spent all that time haven't even talked about Nehemiah's response. That's just the problem. Folks, I don't know what to do. I really don't. I don't know what to do. Let me try to do the best I can, and I'm not going to end where I wanted to end. I'll try to do this in survey form, but I am going to stop and talk a little bit about some of the points. So how did Nehemiah? This is a problem, right? He's got a tiger by the tail here. He's got a real problem on his hands, and it threatens the mission. What's his response? Well, I'm going to tell you right now, it's a masterstroke of leadership. It's an absolute masterstroke of leadership. There are things for us to learn from this, whether we're in leadership, though, or whether it's our own personal lives. So here it is, 4 things. And I'm going to give you sort of a little takeaway point for each one of them. First of all, he realizes the need to be decisive. You have to be decisive. I said that at the beginning. In what way do we see him decisive? Well, I'd say you see him decisive in verse number 7. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and said unto them, ye exact usury every one of his brother, and I set a great assembly against them. I'd say that's being decisive. I'd say that's facing your problems. I'd say that's not calling a truce. I'd say that's putting it right out on the table to deal with. Now, you notice in the verse before this, it talks about anger. And I was very angry when I heard their cry, that is the cry of the people and these words. I want to tell you something. This anger was just. It is such a thing as righteous indignation. This anger was completely just on his part, but here is a real spiritual lesson to take away. He gives it some time before he implements the actions that he's thinking of. Verse next says, then I consulted with myself. And again, to smooth that out just a little bit, after serious thought, anger's not wrong always. Sometimes it is. Sinful anger is sinful anger. Righteous indignation is another thing. But this is really something to learn. This is really something to observe from this man's life. It's sort of like writing a letter when you're upset. Don't mail it. Write the letter if that helps you vent, but don't mail it. You are invariably going to make a mistake. Someone has said it this way. There are some letters that should be written and never sent. Other times you write a letter and you just put that thing. I can't tell you how many times I've done this. It is almost my unswerving practice when I have to write a letter that I think is delicate, whether it's confronting a problem or what it is, to write the letter, stew over it, sit it down and let it ferment a little, see what happens. And when I get what I think is close to a finished product, I'll always ask for one, two, or three close counselors to look at the letter before I send it. The anger's not wrong. It's justifiable, but boy, this is really smart. Now, another observation for us here is the rebuke is public. Was that right? He called them out. Yes, it was right. Why was it right? It was right because the sin was public. And I know rebuke is, and by the way, we can document this from any number of other places in the Scripture. 1 Timothy 5:20, he talks about the elders and tells Timothy, those who sin, rebuke openly, that others may fear. There is a time for this. There's a time to keep it private when it's just between you and someone else, and there's a time when it's affecting other people and it's public to make it public. And I mentioned in a previous sermon that rebuke has its place over and again in the pastoral epistles. Preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. In Titus, he told Titus, he said, these Cretans are lazy. And the witness is true, wherefore rebuke them sharply. Hello? In the very next chapter, these things speak and rebuke and teach with all authority. There's a place for it. And what I really want to say to you, though, is boy, when it happens, there's two things have to happen. Number one, the spirit has to be right on the part of just and right on the part of the person doing it. And the spirit of the person receiving it, boy, that's where the trial comes, isn't it? That really is tough. It's too practical for me not to share this with you, so if you'd just be patient. It seems like I'm forever asking you to be patient. But this is tough, folks. This is where the rubber meets the road. How easy is it to be taken to task? How easy is it for someone to approach you? How easy do you make it? That's an interesting thought right there. How easy do you make it when someone needs to come talk to you? Does the atmosphere become so tense and electric that the person who wants to talk to you and wants to try to make a reasonable effort is so tense and so worried about how you're going to respond? Well, we have to work on that. What's our spirit when we do it? What's the spirit of the person who's listening to it? But I'm going to tell you, I don't care how you cut it, it isn't easy. It's just not, it goes against the grain. If you get to the place where when somebody comes to talk to you about problems and needs in your life, you find that easy, come let me know because I really want to figure out how you did that. It just goes contrary to the flesh. And I wanted to share something with you that Henry Bosch is now deceased, but he was one of the Daily Bread writers. He passed away in 1995, so you don't see him anymore. And I'll leave it there. But he said this, when we're criticized, we ought to ask ourselves whether the criticism contains any truth. If it does, we should learn from it, even when it is not given with the right motivation and in the right spirit. And then he offered 4 points. You won't have time to write this down, so if you want it, I'll give it to you later. But you can at least listen in. Here's what he said. 4 suggestions for how to handle it when it comes. Number one, commit the matter instantly to God, asking Him to remove all resentment and counter-criticism on your part and teach you the needed lessons. Wow. In other words, just knock down the tendency to be defensive and resentful from the beginning. Number two, remember that we are all great sinners and that the one who has criticized us does not begin to know the worst about us. Isn't that the truth? Number three, if you have made a mistake or committed a sin, humbly and frankly confess it to God and to anyone you may have injured. And number four, be willing to learn afresh that you are not infallible and that you need God's grace and wisdom every moment of the day to keep on the straight path. That's it, folks. That's it. So first we see a public rebuke, and it's because he realizes the need to be decisive. But don't forget, it's the prayer and piety that's the foundation of all this already. Second is a personal appeal. He realizes this, and here's the takeaway. He realizes that he has to reach not just the head, but the heart. You do have to reach the head. And in what way did he reach the head? He tells them exactly what he wants them to do. Look at verse 11. Restore, I pray you, to them, even this day. Here's how you're going to make this right. Here's what you've done wrong. Here's what you need to do to make this right. I tell you something, I don't always do it, but I have found as a pastor that the thing that needs to be done more than anything else is think through what you believe God wants people to do in response to the actions that you're taking and then ask them to do it. If you don't know what you're really thinking, you preach a sermon, but you don't really know what you're thinking. You don't really know what you're asking. And of course, there's always that element there that you never know how God is working in people's hearts and lives. But really, where are you moving this to? What do you really want to ask people to do? And the more times you can articulate that clearly to people so that they understand what it is that this thing is moving towards and what needs to be done, well, the greater chance that the clarity helps people focus and accomplish the thing that needs to be accomplished and respond in the way that they should respond. So he tells them, here's what you need to do. Restore, I pray you, to them even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards. Here's what I want you to do. Here's what you should do. He's already based it on biblical truth. What you're doing is wrong. What you're doing is unbecoming. What you're doing is unthinking. So we won't go further into that. But, you know, you can reach the head, and if you don't reach the heart, how does he reach the heart? He reaches the heart by showing them his own life, by showing them his own example. Verse 8, I said unto them, we after our ability have redeemed our brethren, the Jews, which were sold to the heathen. He said, you know, you guys are forcing them into further indenture, and you guys are even thinking about selling them to their own brethren. And he said, what I've been working on is trying to scrimp up a little bit of money to redeem every one of them I can that have already been indentured to the heathen, that is, the unsaved around them. And he uses the moral high road that he keeps his life on. He has to do that to be a leader. When he gets done with the end of verse 8, look at the effect that it has. At the end it says, then held they their peace and found nothing to answer. What could they say? He wasn't asking them to do something that he wasn't already doing. His own life showed the standard. And then he reasoned further. He said, this isn't good. Don't you see this isn't good? And he brings up the point about the reproach of the heathen that we talked about earlier. And then back to example again. I likewise and my brethren, he says, are lending. It's a little smoother if you render it this way. Instead of might exact, you render it, are lending them money. In other words, he's saying, we're trying to buy back as many of them as we can, and these people that are hurting over here for money, we're trying to buy food, we're trying to give what we can to them. So the second little takeaway in the personal appeal is that he realizes the need to reach both the heart and the head. The third is practical accountability. Look at verses 12 and 13. Then said they, we will restore them. Praise the Lord. It does work sometimes. It really does. If you do things God's way, see, because I'm telling you before, we don't need to fear doing right. It might get bumpy in the early term, but you don't need to fear doing right because God blesses when you try to do what's right. And he blessed here. It worked in the hearts of these people. But then look what he did. Then I called the priests, middle of the verse, and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. What did he realize here? What's the takeaway here? Well, talk is cheap. He set a public assembly against them. That had the effect of somewhat embarrassing them. So many of them responded and said, yes, we'll do this. We'll restore the lands. But Nehemiah knew the weakness of the flesh because he knew the weakness of his own flesh. And he said, you know, it's going to be easy for these people to do this here in this moment of pressure, and it's going to be easy for them to slip away from it. And I don't take a thing away from what happened here Wednesday night, because I'll tell you what, we had a great service here Wednesday night. If you weren't here to hear Tom Palmer, you missed. That was a fantastic message. But we got right to the end. He was giving the invitation. And I, look, I'm a preacher. I understand exactly what he was doing and maybe why he did it. But, I mean, that thing came to a point of intense spiritual culmination and pressure, right? It really did if God was speaking to your heart. And in the invitation, he talked about coming here. But then he said, well, but you know, I don't care. You can sit where you are. It doesn't really matter. You just talk to God. I understand that. I've done that a bunch of times myself. But the minute I heard it, it just worried me a little. Not that I question his motive or what he's doing, just worried me a little. Too easy to sit where you are. Too easy to sit there and say, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do what it is God wants me to do. One person came forward. I don't know how many people sat where they were and talked to God. I'm not the judge of that. One person came forward. I'm telling you right now, that's why we do this sometimes. It's not to publish in the sword of the Lord. It's not so we can glory in it. It's because what you repent of in private is 10 times easier to go back to. And sometimes, as I often say in these invitations, we just need to put ourselves on a little extra notice. Sometimes we need to humble ourselves and come forward and pray here at the front, because then our family knows, or then maybe it's the people around us sense. It's not, you're not doing anything for public show, but I often think to myself, are we too good for that in this church? Well, I know he was preaching to a Wednesday night crowd. But still. And the third or fourth thing is, there's a powerful example. I already mentioned what he was doing in verses 8 through 10, but man, we don't even have time for verses 14 through 19. He talks about, you know, the governor. He's writing this later. He's looking back over 12 years of being the governor. He says, you know, I never took the governor's allotment. For the governor, they allow you so much food. He said, I have 150 people coming to my table. And if you read these verses carefully, what he's really saying is, I never accepted any of the money for that. I never accepted any of the allotment that the governor could have. I didn't act like the people who were here before as a burden on the people around me when they were already poor. He paid for it himself. Can you imagine paying for 150 people at your table? I'm saying that's a spirit of self-sacrifice. That's being personally invested. That's powerful when people see that. And what's the takeaway from this? What I said earlier, he realizes you can never lead people to go where you're not willing to go yourself. So folks, I have to end the message, but I'm going to tell you this. Here's my thought. So often we are afraid to be bold. We're afraid to be decisive. We're willing, when we face problems, rather to call a truce than to be bold and decisive in our response, especially if it involves people, which is why I chose Proverbs 29:25 for the verse in the bulletin today. The fear of man bringeth a snare. But interestingly, it's counterbalanced by this statement, but whoso trusteth in the Lord isn't going to be easy to do this, to confront this problem, especially if it involves other people. It just flat out isn't going to be easy. And no one guaranteed it would be easy or that the ride wouldn't be bumpy for a while. But if you trust in the Lord, you'll be safe. Ultimately, you'll be safe, assuming that you've done the right thing. We don't need to be afraid of commitment, and we don't need to be afraid of people, even though our tendency in the flesh is to be afraid of both. Instead, we need to undergird our actions by prayer. We need to arrive at what we know God is leading us to do, whether it's in our personal lives or in our private lives, and we need to commit to doing it. even if it's difficult in the short term. And I don't have time to tell you anything more. I'd like to tell you a story about that, but I don't have time. Because at the end of the day, as I said earlier, even though we fear to be decisive and even though we fear commitment, at the end of the day, God's blessing is assured. Not only did he work in the hearts of these people and they said, we will restore, but we get down to verse 16 and you know what? I'll show it to you again. Yea, also I continued in the work of this wall. The mission was intact. I'm going to tell you something as I close this message today. That's what I want more than anything else in the world. When I'm done here, I don't know when that is, but when I'm done here, I want the mission to be intact. I want Calvary Independent Baptist Church, as it was when I founded it, to be committed to glorifying God by reaching the lost and by growing and developing God's people to do the work of the ministry. I want the mission to be intact. And we will face our challenges from without and we will face our challenges from within. But if we commit our hearts to do the right as God gives us to see the right, we need not fear.